Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And we have a hot item to talk to you about today.
This is just indicative of how this entire podcast is going to go, isn't it?
It's going to be a smoking episode.
A scorcher.
Yeah. We're talking about fire. You know, because here's the thing. We wanted to look into camping gear, and we did. And as we were doing it, we saw all these cool things about different fire starting technology. And we thought, you know, it'd be kind of cool to talk about this. But the more we saw, the more we thought, well, this is just going to completely dominate this episode.
This could, in fact, be a whole episode.
And then, wait a minute, we have the full power to make it an entire episode. So that's what we're going to do.
So we did.
So, first of all, we should mention that fire, obviously, one of the most important discoveries that early humans made.
It's a pretty critical technology to human existence.
Yeah, you could argue that because it's, you know, technically part of a chemical reaction, maybe you don't call it a technology, but it plays an integral role in so much of our tech.
And certainly the technology that we use to create it.
Yeah, I mean, that's technology.
It's technological.
Certainly. So we're going to cover everything from low-tech ways of making fire to some pretty pretty high-tech and terrifying, obviously, ways to make fire. So we've spent a lot of human history, not we personally, humans as a general rule, have spent a lot of history learning of different ways to make fire, to control fire, to extinguish fire. We've had full episodes on firefighting technologies in the past. But what is fire? So this is part of that chemical reaction I was talking about. It's essentially a chemical reaction between oxygen and some sort of fuel source that has reached its ignition temperature.
AKA the temperature at which it will burn.
Right. So when a substance, whatever it may be, has reached that temperature, if it is in the presence of oxygen, it will burn, and thus we get fire. Now, flames from a fire keep the fuel at its ignition temperature. That means the reaction becomes self-sustaining as long as you have fuel, which is, you know, that's the dangerous thing about fire, right? This is a chemical reaction that's just going to continue until all the fuel is gone or you have otherwise found a way to extinguish it, perhaps by removing the oxygen from the environment or
dampening it with something.
Yeah. So, which lowers the temperature as well. Yeah. So this is the obviously the very dangerous part about fires, that you want to make sure that you have a controlled environment where you can control exactly how much fuel is being added to the fire. Mm-hmm. To make sure you don't have a nasty situation pop up.
Though you mentioned ignition temperature,
yeah.
And technically any given fuel has two different ignition temperatures.
That's true. There's the piloted ignition temperature. That's how hot a fuel needs to be before it will catch fire in the presence of a spark. So it doesn't have to be as hot as if you don't have any sparks there for an object to burst into flame in the presence of oxygen. Its temperature has to be much higher. That's the unpiloted ignition temperature.
Right. That's kind of the spontaneous combustion sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, except that means a different thing, but.
But similar, right. So, for instance, if you were to heat up a piece of wood to a certain temperature and then hit it with a spark, it'll start to catch fire. You would have to heat it to a much higher temperature for it to just start burning.
Unto itself.
Yeah. So, That's one thing we should point out. Now, granted, we're going to mostly be talking about piloted ignition temperatures because we're talking about helping things along by adding a little spark to it. And also something to remember, that fuel that has a large surface area to volume ratio burns more readily, meaning that if you've got a lot of surface area and you don't have a lot of volume, you can heat up and get to that ignition temperature much faster than if you had a lot of bulk to you, because that temperature could then be conducted away from the point of heat. And it takes longer for you to actually get that to catch fire.
Also, as a fuel source itself, it's going to have more exposure to oxygen.
Yes.
And therefore.
Yes, exactly. So, one of the many reasons why you want to use little bits of tinder before throwing logs onto a fire. I mean, the tinder is going to catch fire more easily. And then you can start to build up from there. So going very, very basic. What is the most basic way early humans interacted with fire?
Finding some fire and then using it for stuff.
Right. So this isn't so much making it. This is, what is that big hot orange thing over there? Let's go check it out.
I bet we can do something with that.
Yeah.
And the thing is that there's evidence that proto-humans were deliberately controlling this natural found fire to do work for them as long as 1.5 million years ago.
Right. So once you figure out, oh, this fire eats stuff. If we
and
keep,
produces heat.
Yeah, if we keep feeding it, it will stay around. If we stop feeding it, then it could go out.
And we can kind of bring it over here if we want to.
Yeah, yeah. We have to be real careful about that. But yeah, this is all before we had found ways to necessarily make it ourselves. It was just taking advantage of something that was found. You know, and of course, fires happen in nature for multiple reasons.
Oh, sure.
So, but if we wanted to make it ourselves, in fact, this is something that we can still do. This is what early humans did. And if you're really determined and you are patient, oh, you can do it too.
People still do it today. Sure.
You can make fire through friction. So first we got to talk about friction. Friction is the resistance to the relative motion of two solid objects that are in contact with one another. So in other words, like if, we have a table here in front of us, I have my hand on the table. If I wanted to slide my hand across the table, first I have to put enough force to overcome this resistance to the motion, this friction. And even then, I'm going to feel the friction as my hand moves across the table. Now, the actual amount of friction is usually proportional to the force pressing the surfaces of the two objects together. So if I'm pressing down really hard on the table and then try to move my hand, I'm going to encounter more friction than if I just very lightly had my hand on the table. Obviously friction can be things that are, you know, an object that's just on a flat surface that's not moving at all, and maybe it's an inclined surface, and the normal force, the force that's pressing the surfaces together, would just be gravity in that case. But you can also have two different objects that are experiencing friction against each other that aren't, you know, gravity is not the main force at play.
Right.
That's also totally possible. So the roughness of the surfaces also affects the amount of resistance that they have to moving against each other. That makes sense, right? If you're using a rough sandpaper against some wood, then it ends up feeling, you can feel that resistance and you can feel the heat, certainly,
mm-hmm.
using that a little bit. If you use a really finely grained piece of sandpaper, the resistance isn't as much. You're going to be able to move that paper a little more easily. Interestingly enough, This only is true to a point.
Right. This is relatively simplified because if you, as it turns out, okay, if you take two perfectly smooth sheets of metal.
Yes. Like flawlessly smooth.
Uh-huh. And you put them in a vacuum.
Right.
And you try to rub them against each other.
Yeah. They adhere.
They adhere.
It's called cold welding. They actually, on a molecular level, adhere to one another. So at this point, you would think, normally, if you're talking about perfectly smooth surfaces, you would think frictionless. You would think, oh, well, those things are just going to slide right off each other. But actually, the opposite is true. They will cold weld together on a molecular level. So just keep that in mind, that when we're talking about friction, we are simplifying things. We're using a very kind of macro look at it. There's also the coefficient of friction. That's essentially the amount of resistance that you have, that ratio of the frictional resistance force to that normal force pressing together the two surfaces. So you're moving one object against another object, and some of that energy you put into moving the object goes to overcoming that friction, and that energy is not lost because you don't lose
energy.
Yeah, you don't create or destroy it. You just convert it.
It's converted into heat.
Yes. So whatever heat, whatever energy would have been used overcoming that friction gets converted into heat. So when you rub two sticks together, those contacting surfaces start to heat up. And if you rub them together fast enough and for long enough, the dust or char that's given off by those sticks will grow hot enough to glow, and that becomes your coal. So the coal in this case is not coal like you would dig out of the ground. We're talking about an ember.
Right.
Something that is so hot that it may be glowing, giving off light as well as heat. And then you would introduce that coal to tinder in order to get a flame going. And you can do this with sticks, although more frequently you'll have something like a board and a stick, and you'll do a hand drill so that you drill a stick against the board and you start boring a hole. And as a result, the dust that's around the hole will get hot. And if it gets hot enough, it becomes a coal. Or you might have a piece of hardwood that's like a rod, and some soft wood that has a little trough dug in it, and you just rub the end of the rod through the trough rapidly, and that also will generate this very hot char that eventually will get hot enough for it to become a coal, and then you can light a fire.
Oh, yeah.
It sounds like it's really easy. This is not something that's necessarily easy. It actually takes quite a bit of practice, usually. I mean, people who try it for the first time are rarely successful unless they have the careful guidance of an expert who has done it before, because, you know, it can be exhausting. It takes a lot of patience and a lot of strength and endurance, especially if you don't have the technique down. If you haven't built up calluses on your hands, it can also be painful.
Oh, ow, yeah.
Yeah. But it is certainly a possible thing to do. I mean, people do it all the time. You probably have seen television shows, whether they are fictional or documentaries, where people have done this kind of method.
And YouTube is just full of instructional videos if you want to learn how to do this
Absolutely.
Yourself. And you may be saying to yourself that, hey, this isn't really a technology.
Yeah.
But there are a few tricks or hacks or whatever you want to call it that you can use that will move it a little bit closer into the realm of technology, like adding a little bit of grit to the surface of the sticks to increase the friction between them.
Right.
Or creating a simple pulley system using a sturdy strap to help you to help make the movement easier.
Right. So, I mean, like the bow method where you have the bow where the string is wrapped around one of the sticks and you use that to make the...
To spin it.
Yeah, to spin it really, really fast.
Yeah.
So, yeah, these are basic tools, but basic tools are the foundation of technology.
Yes. And we're not sure, I mean, not just us, but humanity in general is not sure how long we have been using this particular form of fire starting.
We certainly have been doing it longer than we've been writing.
Yes. And, you know, at a certain point, sticks really don't hold up that well to the tests of time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, it's one of those things where you can't really necessarily go back and find lots of evidence for exactly how you might be able to find evidence of a fire, but not necessarily know how they got it started.
Right.
You know, was this something that they used the whole rubbing sticks together thing, or was this they found fire and brought it back?
I think the oldest sticks that I've seen mentioned in a museum website were some 4,000 years old, but that seems awfully young for this kind of thing.
Considering that, you know, we've been using fire in some form or another for more than a million years.
Yeah.
So then moving on to flint and steel, or other metals, or technically other minerals as well. You probably have heard of flint and steel, particularly if you play Minecraft, because it's one of the things you can make.
Running a business is no cakewalk.
There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
So flint is a hard sedimentary rock, and it has a type of microcrystalline quartz structure to it. Geologists call it chert.
Which is just a great word.
I call it Bob. No, it's been used in tool making for a while, right?
Some 2 million years, yeah.
So
it can break into very sharp pieces, yes, due to that structure, that crystalline structure.
So it makes really good knives or spear or arrowheads. So it's been used in lots of different types of tools. And when you strike it against steel, you end up getting this spark that's really good for a fire. And actually, in my notes, I wrote flint gives off a spark suitable for starting a fire, but that's not really true. It's actually the steel that's giving off the spark.
Right.
So here's the interesting thing. Now, this is going to be different when we talk about modern day lighters that use a very similar approach. But the idea is that you are creating the friction generated by this strike. You're trying to strike it from an angle. You know, it's not like direct on, like slam iron against a piece of flint. You're doing this kind of angular motion. And the point is that you're trying to create friction generated by this strike to knock off little pieces of steel or iron. I mean, steel really is refined iron.
Oh, right. And that works because the flint is harder than the steel.
Yes. So you will actually have the flint knock little pieces of steel off. Now, those pieces are heated above the ignition temperature for iron based on those tiny, tiny particles that are getting knocked off. Again, we're talking about that surface area to volume ratio.
Right. The ignition temperature of iron is actually very low.
Yeah. Well,
comparatively.
When you get it into the tiny little pieces, certainly. If you're looking at it in bulk, very high. But you might be asking, well, what else is going on here? Well, the presence of oxygen is what's allowing those pieces to heat up even more, because iron has something called pyrophoricity. And you might say, what is pyrophoricity?
It means that it will ignite in the presence of oxygen.
Yeah. And you might say, wait a minute. I have a wrought iron fence, and I can't even remember a single day when it was on fire.
It's super not on fire.
Yeah. It is probably the least on fire thing that's in my house or around my house. It's because that has a coat of iron oxide on it. So iron oxide also, we call that rust. But, you know, iron goes through this oxidation process. When you have it in bulk, the heat generated from that oxidation process means that it can be conducted through the rest of the material. And that's why it doesn't heat up to a point where it
burns.
Yeah, bursts into flames.
Yeah.
But if it's a really, really small piece that is suddenly exposed to oxygen, then there's nowhere for that heat to go. It just ends up becoming this oxidized, super hot mass, super hot for its size anyway, and can be very, can essentially become molten, which then you can use to set fire something. Yeah.
Tinder
usually, yes.
Usually. Humans have been using this method for some 4,000 to 10,000 years, which means, of course, that the earliest flint-based fire starters were not using steel at all, which was invented in the Bronze and or Iron Age some, less than 4,000 years ago, right?
So the earlier stuff was using something else, right?
Iron pyrite, aka fool's gold. Instruments of those types have been found dating back way farther. And I did want to say that part of this technology is really also a tinder materials technology issue, because as we have improved ways of creating tinder and carrying it and keeping it dry, we have been able to more effectively use flint and steel to create fire. Around the world, tinder has been made from everything from like simple bits of dried grass or bark to decaying tree fungus, which is apparently really effective at starting fires. I'm not sure. I've never tried it. Mm. And it's been carried in everything from really ornate brass or enameled boxes to goat testicle leather.
Okay. I have no response to that.
We're learning things.
I do remember watching, I think it was Survivor, where the guy would end up getting a spark from flint and steel, essentially, and then lighting some tinder and then carrying a handful of smoking tinder to where he was going to light his fire. And the whole time I was thinking, please don't burn yourself, Mr. Nice Canadian Man. And then, of course, he would make a fire, like a fire bundle, which would have a smoking ember inside of it. And that would allow him to carry his fire with him to his next site, where he would then use that ember to help light the fire. And thus he wouldn't have to create a new coal.
Spark. Right. Yeah. Not all tinder is carried already on fire.
Yes. Some of it is just carried so that
it's pretty frequently just kept very dry and safe.
Right. Right.
At any rate, speaking of tinder, though, hey, there was a thing called the tinder pistol.
So it was softer than regular pistols. A tinder pistol.
No. This was in the 1600s.
Okay.
It was sort of a step between the flint and steel kits and lighters that we have today. Okay. And they were converted flintlock pistols. They consist of the handle and trigger of a pistol with a small tinder box where the barrel of the pistol would be.
Okay.
Pulling the trigger would pull back the lid on the tinder box and simultaneously engage the flintlock mechanism, which would send sparks into the tinder. And now we've talked a little bit on the show before about flintlock guns. It was in our 3D printed guns episode.
Yep. We also have an episode from way, way back about the technology of 1510, where Chris Paulette and I talked a lot about flintlock pistols in that one. So if you really want a full rundown on the flintlock, you can listen to that old episode of Tech Stuff.
But a quick refresher, just because they're such elegant machines.
Yeah.
So the flintlock pistol's hammer is actually a lever that holds a bit of flint at one end and is attached to a spring at the other end. Mm-hmm. And that spring connects to the gun's trigger. All right. So when you pull the trigger, it springs the flint edge of the hammer into contact with a bit of steel called a frizzen, which creates sparks, which light the material at hand. In a pistol, it would be gunpowder. And in our case, it is tinder. So you reload the spring by simply pulling back the hammer again.
Interesting.
Not difficult. But these tinder pistols, though, were household items. They really weren't meant to be portable. And all the models that I've seen included these really heavy legs so that they could sit kind of elegantly on a table. Flintlock pistols were really new and expensive in the early to mid 1600s.
Yeah.
So it was definitely a measure of wealth to own such a contraption just for lighting candles and your tobacco products and et cetera.
Right. You know, one thing that I wanted to talk about, because I thought you know, it's, again, a very simple technology that a lot of us take for granted, especially since it's not that frequent that most of us come into contact with this anymore. But it's just, I want to talk about matches. And the reason is because it's a cool use of our knowledge of friction and chemistry to be able to create fire in a manageable way. And it really made it much, much easier to produce fire. Now, they're relatively recent inventions, although the earliest research dates all the way back to the late 17th century, 1680. And that's when a philosopher, physicist, chemist, professional smart person named Robert Boyle began to experiment with phosphorus, which is a pretty volatile material. And he coated a coarse piece of paper with phosphorus and then found that by moving a piece of wood coated in sulfur against that phosphorus coated paper, he could produce fire. You just had to move fast enough for the friction to generate the heat necessary to get above that ignition temperature. But his ingredients were also kind of toxic, so it wasn't really practical to make that as, like, this is the new fire-starting technology of the 17th century.
Yeah, no.
So you get to a century later, 1780, French physicists invent the phosphoric candle. Now, this is super interesting to me because I can't imagine what it must have looked like to light something using this thing.
It sounds very traumatic.
Yeah, so imagine that you've got a piece of paper or some string. It's coated in wax, and it's been tipped with phosphorus and sealed in a glass container. So you've got this glass container inside of which is this string or glass or paper. And then if you wanted to light the match, you would have to break the glass.
Because upon being exposed to air, the phosphorus would ignite and set fire to the paper and or string.
Yeah, so in case of a need for fire, break glass. It's kind of the opposite of what we usually see.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, not, obviously not practical. Very interesting, but not practical. Then, let's see if I can say this word that as far as I know, didn't exist until this thing was invented. In 1805, you have the oxymuriated match.
Also, looks good to me.
Yeah, it's also known as the instantaneous light box, which I think is a much nicer name. Now, this was also kind of a scary way to start a fire. So you would use little pieces of wood that had been treated chemically, so that when exposed to sulfuric acid, which serious stuff there, but when exposed to sulfuric acid, the wood would burst into flame.
So you dip these bits of wood into sulfuric acid,
yeah,
and you create fire. Why doesn't every child have one of these?
I think the sulfuric acid alone answers that question. But yeah, it was interesting. And again, this was all leading up to 1827 when a man named John Walker, an Englishman, invented the friction match, which were 3-inch long pieces of wood that were tipped with potassium chlorate, antimony sulfide, gum, and starch. So drawing this match against any rough surface like sandpaper would cause these chemicals to mix, and because you had added heat from friction
and oxygen from the air,
they would end up bursting into flame. They hit that ignition temperature and then boom. And you also kind of get a lot of sputtering. Like this was,
a little bit like a sparkler almost.
Yeah. So one description I saw said it was kind of like listening to a bunch of firecrackers go off. Not as loud, but
sure,
you get those little popping noises.
Yeah.
And then
Pop rocks.
Later on, you would see very similar matches coated with sulfur and white phosphorus, which could be struck pretty much anywhere, including like on clothing. So if you've ever watched movies or television shows where you have that person who just, uses the match and rubs it really quickly against pretty much anything.
Like their own beard or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
a tabletop.
Essentially, that's these sorts of matches. But also has some drawbacks. So remember that way back when Boyle was practicing with his, he had those toxic fumes given off. Same sort of thing. The gas given off in this ignition process was pretty toxic. So, in fact, there were people who would market these matches, and I think they were called Lucifers originally. And they said, "Don't breathe in the fumes."
Yeah. Oh, white phosphorus is bad times for that kind of thing.
Not good. So here's the question: we have those matches. You can light against practically any surface. Why can't we do that with a match that you buy today? Like, you get a matchbook, you take a match out of the matchbook. Why is it that if I try really hard to light it against coarse sandpaper, nothing happens?
Because all of the chemicals needed to create the ignition are not on the head of the match. Some of them are in the strip of paper that you rub the match against on the back of the matchbook.
Clever. So by limiting where I can strike the match, I make it safer to use.
Right.
Obviously, if you were to introduce enough heat to any match, yes, then it was going to ignite. But on its own, it's not likely to do so unless you were, again, like exposing it to flame or something like that. So, like you say, the match divides up those chemicals onto the striking surface and the match itself.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
I bet you're smart.
Yeah, and you like to hold your own in the group chat.
We can help you drop even more knowledge. My name is Martine Powers.
And I'm Elahe Izadi. We host a daily news podcast called Post Reports.
Every weekday afternoon, Post Reports takes you inside an important and interesting story with the kind of reporting that you can only get from The Washington Post.
You can listen to Post Reports wherever you get your podcasts. Go find it now and hit follow.
So modern matches have chemicals that allow it to ignite evenly so you don't get like that crazy sputtering. And typically your match head has some quick burning chemicals like potassium chlorate on them. The box or matchbook has a strip containing some other chemical, usually something like red phosphorus, which
does not produce those toxic fumes that white phosphorus does. Yay.
Yay. Yeah, which very important, obviously. So yeah, when you strike those matches, the match to that surface together, you get that chemical mix, you get the heat, you get the oxygen, you get fire. So super interesting to me that's how those developed. Then you have electric matches, which are not matches. They're essentially coils of wire, and you run electricity through that coil of wire, and the resistance of that wire means that you lose some of the electricity into the form of heat, which often with electronics is something that's really irritating, right?
You want to avoid that in, for example, your laptop.
Yeah, you want to make sure that all of those pathways are as efficient as possible, that it's generating as little heat as possible, so that way you're getting the most out of your energy
your
that you're
juice.
Pouring into it.
Right, but if you're looking to create heat, you can very easily create a situation where you're going to make all of that resistance happen
right.
and build up as much heat as possible.
Exactly, and then the wire will start to glow. It's giving off photons, and it's really, really hot, and you can ignite stuff with it.
Mm-hmm.
If you have ever used a car cigarette lighter, that's essentially how these work.
Which I don't think exist anymore in cars.
Yeah, if you have an older car, maybe. I remember I burned myself quite badly on a car cigarette lighter, because I remember I distinctly remember this. My father was telling me, like, this is hot. It's really, really hot. You don't want to touch this because it's hot. And as a kid, I thought, that's not hot. And I touched it. Not my dad's fault. Nope. Totally not my dad's fault.
That's a life lesson right there.
And, yeah, I learned my lesson, but dad wasn't trying to, like, you know, let him learn the hard way. He was actually trying to be very responsible. I was the irresponsible jerk in that case. So I want to make that clear that my dad was not abusing me.
I think most humans have a hot things are hot story very much like that in their childhood somewhere.
But this is the same principle that electric heating surfaces use, right? Like if you have an electric stove, that kind of thing, it's essentially using resistance so that the flow of electricity generates heat until you're able to do something with that, whether that's light a fire or cook your meal. So that's what electric matches are, and they come in lots of different forms. Not so much these days. I mean, a few of them do. Like in our camping episode, I didn't mention it because I wanted to talk more about fire making in this episode. But I've seen a portable electric match, essentially. It's really meant to start fires even in a camping situation. But it's not really that different from a cigarette lighter that in the old cars. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much the same sort of thing. All right, so now we get up to, magnesium.
Magnesium fire starters, right, sometimes also called fire steel. This is basically a really efficient form of a flint and steel mechanism. You would draw a steel blade against a bit of magnesium or a magnesium alloy, which would create these super hot sparks. Magnesium flames up around 3,000 degrees Celsius. That's about 5,500 degrees Fahrenheit, which makes it really useful for emergency situations, because first of all, that's a very bright spark that it's producing.
Right.
And second of all, it's really combustible. It's going to combust what you need combusted.
Yeah. No joke. All right. So now we're getting down to lighters, like the butane lighters that, most of us are familiar with in some form or another. So they have a few important parts. One is the spark wheel, which is made up of hardened steel wire.
That's a little bit that you spin with your thumb.
Yeah.
Fail to spin with your thumb in my case. Right. I'm still really incapable of using lighters.
I have very few occasions to use lighters, so it's not really something I do, but that's the case there.
I'm fond of candles.
I am too. I just happen to have one of the long wand style lighters for that. So the wheel grinds against a material that's like flint. Some of them even call it flint. But most of these lighters have a man-made metallic material called ferrocerium in place of flint. Now, the flint being used in these lighters is different from flint and steel. That kind of method is the flint that you would actually find out in rocks, you know, as actual rocks.
It's a mineral.
You would find it in the earth. Now, in that case, the flint is the thing, like we said earlier, that breaks off little pieces of steel, and those heat up, and that's what you use to light your fire.
Mm-hmm.
With a lighter, it's the other way around. The steel is actually harder than this ferrocerium material, and it's the ferrocerium that is oxidizing, that's sparking. So the steel remains pretty much the way it is. This so-called flint gets worn down over time because that's the stuff that's actually sparking.
Yeah, that's similar to the process in that magnesium bit that I was just talking about as well. Right.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's the same basic principle. It's just, it depends on which material it is that's actually sparking. In this case, we also have a compressed spring that provides the pressure needed to hold that ferrocerium up against that wheel. You would imagine if you're using a lighter, then eventually you're starting to wear down that material because you're knocking off little pieces of it that's what's sparking.
Ah, so you need the spring in order to keep the flint flush against the steel bit.
Exactly, yeah. So this spring very gradually extends as the flint gets worn down. Now, granted, it's not something that you would notice unless over a long, long, long period of time. In fact, you're more likely to run out of fuel with your lighter.
Before you would run out of flint.
Exactly. Yeah. And that fuel tends to be butane. You usually have a little canister that's in the base of the lighter that contains the fuel. It is controlled by valves. And when you press down on that little, usually red button, when you flick the wheel, that's what opens up the valve to allow butane to fly through. Now, because you have valves, because you have this controlled release of butane, and because we learned a fire will sustain itself as long as it has fuel because the flame is hot enough to keep it at that ignition temperature. Once you turn that wheel once, you're good. You just have to hold down that little button.
That button.
And
right.
As long as you have fuel, that fire should stay lit. Assuming you don't run into something like really high winds that interrupts that flow of fuel to the flame. So, obviously it was really important to design this in such a way where you weren't going to get any blowback with the fire.
Oh, right. Backdraft.
Yeah.
Would be bad times.
You don't want anything like that. So.
Not nearly as bad as the film.
No. But. No. I have a soft spot in my heart for that movie. But, anyway, yeah, it's an interesting technology. So we thought, where can we go from here? And we thought about talking about blowtorches, but there's a lot to talk about with blowtorches. And there was a choice between blowtorches or our incredibly scary fire-producing technology. And we decided to go with scary.
We decided that flamethrowers are really the way to go.
Yeah. So strap yourselves in, guys.
We couldn't resist.
First of all, weaponizing fire, not a new idea. I mean, you know, anyone who's seen the documentary Robin Hood knows Prince of Thieves, you know, that one with Kevin Costner. That one, obviously, they would use flaming arrows. But we've been using actual kind of early flamethrower ideas for a very long time, like way back in 5th century BCE. Now, these were essentially tubes, like brass tubes, filled with burning stuff. And a warrior would blow on one end of the tube, which would launch the burning stuff out of the other end of the tube, presumably at an enemy.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed.
Now, when you get up to the 7th century CE, that's when the Byzantine Empire began to use Greek fire. This is terrifying stuff to read about.
And we don't actually know what it was made of.
No, we have some suspicions that it was probably some sort of petroleum mix that had some other chemicals in it, but we don't know specifically. The people who made this stuff were very, very secretive in it because obviously it was a
trade secrets, sure.
It was an advantage over all their enemies, right?
Yeah.
It is terrifying. Think of it. Think of being on a ship in the 7th century and seeing streams of flame going into the sky from the walls of the city that you're trying to lay siege to. You might have some second thoughts.
Especially if you're in a wooden ship, which you were at the time.
That would definitely, like, guys, I foresee a problem.
I am perhaps rethinking this idea.
Yeah, so the way this would work, again, is they would have these brass tubes that would be connected to some sort of reservoir. Usually you would also have a pump that would pump the liquid through the tube. It was a single action pump, meaning it was only working on the downstroke.
Okay.
And then you would have some lucky person whose job it was to ignite the fuel when it came out of the tube. There were some people who actually suggested that it's possible the Greek fire would even ignite upon connecting with water.
Huh.
Which is interesting. It's not impossible that that is the case, but the problem is there's no definitive account that tells us exactly how this worked. But it seems that there were more likely these warriors who would essentially hold a torch, light the end of this thing.
Sounds like a really bad job.
Yeah, not necessarily. You probably drew the short straw that day. And it would pump out these flames. And once the pump had finished on its downstroke and goes back up again, the flames would stop because your fuel was cut off. And so the warrior would have to stay there in order to ignite the next stream. Chinese warriors copied this approach and improved upon it by using double bellows, which could pump out flammable liquid both on the upstroke and the downstroke of the bellows itself, because it had this double action going on. So you had a continuous stream of flames coming at you. Definitely going to make you think twice before you try and storm their ranks. Now, these items, these weapons, were really scary. They're absolutely devastating, but they were not portable, because they were usually connected to some sort of reservoir.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not talking about like a personal weapon. This is something that's attached to a larger structure of some sort. And eventually something else came along that was way more effective as a tool of war that essentially replaced flames for a good long time. And that would be
gunpowder.
Yeah. Gunpowder certainly changed warfare dramatically. Everything from the era of the knights in armor to castles to this kind of flame technology, all of that was sort of rendered moot once gunpowder came along.
Mm-hmm. Although flamethrowers did, in fact, come back into warfare, it would take it until about World War I.
Yep. The German army began to introduce flamethrowers into warfare. It wouldn't be till World War II that you'd see both Axis and Allied powers using this technology. And it was pretty terrifying stuff.
Because we had the technology to make them portable.
Yeah.
Yay. This,
now it became a personal weapon, not just something that was connected. Yeah, absolutely. So not all developments in technology are things that we are necessarily like, hooray, yes, awesome. Some of them are like, wow, that is scary stuff.
It's terrifying. It also looks really cool in video games. So
yeah, also,
I guess at a certain point, I can't really argue.
Movies like The Running Man.
Sure.
You know, fireball.
Fictional flamethrowers.
I love fictional flamethrowers. Love them. Yeah, real ones are terrifying.
Jonathan was a little bit upset you guys doing this research.
Well, no, because I was reading about what would happen.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you're talking about burning fuel flying at people. So,
yeah.
But to just focus on the technology and not the application of it.
Right.
Let's talk about that. So these flamethrowers were different. They were portable. A single soldier could carry and operate one. And what it would consist of is a backpack that would essentially have three tanks on it. You have two fuel canisters, and in between them, you would have a pressurized air canister.
Oh, okay.
So the fuel canisters, that's what has whatever the flammable liquid happens to be for your flamethrower. The pressurized air is what forces that fuel to go through the fuel lines and through the gun that you're holding. Now, that fuel flows through to the gun, and that's where you've got two triggers, essentially. One trigger is what allows the fuel to flow through.
Right.
And the other one is the igniter. And they had different igniters depending upon the era of flamethrower. Like the early ones used resistance coil, very similar to the electric matches we were talking about. So you just have this really hot coil of wire. The fuel would pass through it, essentially, or against it, and that would hit its ignition temperature. The flame would start. And of course, once the flame started, it was enough to keep that flame going. You could let go of the igniter at that point, just hold on to the fuel. Same sort of thing with the more modern ones, except they use spark plugs. So you've got a battery, and the battery provides electricity to the spark plug, which generates a spark. That's what allows the fuel to catch fire. And again, as long as you've got fuel going through the flamethrower, you're going to be shooting flames out. So interesting stuff. But, you know, let's not stop there. You know, that's terrifying all on its own. You see a soldier shooting flame out. That's very intimidating.
Uh-huh. But you can also make very large mobile flamethrowers these days.
Yeah, you could attach it to something like, I don't know, a tank. Now, the reason why it gets even more terrifying with a tank is that not only do you have this enormous armored vehicle bearing down at you, the pump in this vehicle is attached directly to its motor. So it's way more powerful.
So the tank's engine, oh my goodness, is powering the flow of the fluid.
Yes. So you can shoot it way further than you could with a handheld flamethrower. So you get the propulsion of fuel would go much further. And obviously, again, a very effective intimidation tool, not to mention just an outright devastating weapon. So, yeah, those are the methods that we wanted to cover about technology that makes flames. Obviously, we didn't cover other things like, you can use light to make flames.
Right.
You could use lasers. You could use lenses that focus light to a point.
Mm-hmm.
So there are other options that we didn't cover. Maybe one day we'll do a second episode.
Yeah, if any of you guys out there are kind of pyros and would like to hear more, then definitely let us know.
Particularly if there is some method that you thought, hey, you know, I was hoping you were going to cover
that
and we didn't. Let us know. Tell us what we missed and we will consider doing a second episode. And I feel that we are justified in doing this episode only because we have done episodes about how fire engines work. We've done episodes on how the Boston fire alarm system worked. You know, we have all of that kind of stuff. So
this is responsible. We're being responsible.
Responsible
here.
Journalists. We have to tell both sides of the story. Clearly, if I learned nothing from browsing through a journalism school's brochure, I learned that. So, guys, if you have any suggestions for future episodes of Tech Stuff, write in to us. Let us know. Our email address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com. Or drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Tumblr. Our handle at all three is TechStuffHSW. And we'll talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.